I'm Kyle Roberts, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben.
Hey, Ilya, what's up, man?
It's time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. On the show today, Kyle Roberts. Kyle Roberts, who's a DP, rental house, camera owner, operator. He is a man's man, ladies' man, man about town. He is based in Birmingham, Alabama. Kyle's an interesting guy. He's got opinions about gear and work and everything else. And I believe that a lot of our listeners will feel a kinship, especially if they are in smaller markets or different parts of the country where they're, you know, grinding out different sorts of work on different projects, you know, day in and day out. So that's Kyle, and we're going to get into it in just one moment. But first, we got to talk about Close Focus.
And now, Close Focus.
What are we talking about, Ben?
We had talked last week about you doing your NAB wrap-up this week because we were right out of NAB, but you kind of wanted a minute to process it. And if my YouTube feed is to be trusted, and it always is, the number one news out of NAB is the Blackmagic Pixis. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think so. Yes, the Pixis. I got to play with that camera for a while. It's a little tiny box camera, costs $3,000, has most of the features that people are going to want in a little camera like that. It's particularly limiting in a couple of ways, but, you know, Blackmagic wants to make a camera that is appropriately, you know, priced and featured compared to their very exhaustive lineup of several, you know, other cameras that are inexpensive. And I think it'll do well.
It's a long road from their production camera, I'll tell you that.
It is.
That freaking brick that you put a lens on.
But it's the same price.
The footage looked pretty good.
It's,
yeah, yeah.
It's $29.95. So, you know, look, I got to give credit. Blackmagic seems to capture the imagination out there more so than some other companies. And when they announce a camera, there's a huge crowd of people who really want to believe, who want that camera to be kind of like the be-all, end-all for them. So the cameras that they had at NAB were not final, so we don't get to see exactly, you know, everything about them, but they seem to work pretty well. And I'm reserving full judgment until they get a fully shipping camera. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but this was only one of three sort of new cameras they announced. They had a bigger camera, a bigger brother, so to speak, which is a large format with a new sensor and what they advertise as 12K. It has a 12K raster. You record a 12K file. And then an even bigger one, which is like almost a medium format or in 65 millimeter size.
Yeah, it's
sensor.
Like IMAX. Yeah,
like IMAX. They were,
yeah.
But they don't have any pricing. They don't know when it's going to be available. So
I got to be honest, 12K seems excessive to me. Maybe call me old fashioned, but I sort of feel like 8K is good if you're, because like you're probably going to finish to 4K. And so 8K gives you a little bit of wiggle room, but 12K just seems like insanity. Like it just, I mean, like if it's not taking up lots of hard drive space or whatever, then I guess it doesn't matter. But my guess is it takes up crazy amounts of hard drive space.
It's compressed, so they don't take up quite as much space. But, you know, when you're talking about a parent resolution, you have to actually do the Pepsi challenge. It doesn't have what I think most people out there would consider a 12K apparent image, but it is a 12K raster, which is a term that I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand. But raster is actually the file that is being recorded is 12K. So I give them a pass. It's not like they're being deceptive. That is a 12K camera.
Yeah, but it goes back to like back in the day before Arri had graduated to higher resolutions and they had the original Alexa, which I think maxed out at, what was it, like 2.5K if you had like add-on hard drives and stuff like that to get it. And Arri's whole argument was it doesn't matter it doesn't matter the number of pixels, it matters the quality of the pixels.
100%. And that is never...
They're Arri and they're the best. So are we getting, if we're getting 12K, are we getting a quality 12K, or are we getting something that basically is roughly the equivalent to 4K but somehow is split up into other stuff? Because the second you tell me it's compressed, I'm like, okay, what's the point then?
Yeah, I think that there's quite a few people who feel that way. And I have to say that the camera assessment series, which tested the current 12K camera, look, it's good and it's surprisingly good for the money. But I don't think that anyone should really be persuaded to think that they are shooting some huge amount of resolution that other cameras can't match. It is absolutely the quality of the pixels and also the quality of the math, the way that those pixels are constructed. Actually, the photo sites that are capturing the light are then taking those photons, turning them into electrons, and the quality of the math that puts it all together, that's really what matters. So I have not done the challenge to try to disprove that 12K number. It's a 12K file. That's good enough for me. But really, everyone who's an informed consumer out there, I think, understands that that's not necessarily 12K of apparent resolution. That apparent resolution is something that's quite different. And you need to compare that to other cameras if that's really what you're thinking it is.
What are some of the other big news stories from NAB?
It's sort
from
of a
the NAB.
Yeah, it's sort of a maturing of the Chinese lens market. There's a lot of Chinese cinema lenses out there, and most of the major companies, I'm thinking of companies like DZO and Laowa, have new versions or new focal lengths for sets or zooms that already exist. Also, there used to be sort of be this like back alley in the central hall where all of the lens manufacturers and different companies would kind of be crowded into these little booths. You can't say that anymore. Almost all of those companies have sort of grown and moved out of there in a real way that I want to say they feel so much larger and more legitimate as options compared to just a few years ago. So DJI, of course, had a big presence, and they introduced a new, very professionally featured remote focus system, which is very interesting. Look, no one should be surprised, but batteries and LED lights, a lot of that stuff is coming out of China. But that's maturing and getting better as well, too. Core Batteries has a new sort of battery packs that connect together with magnets. And they're going to be particularly popular, I think, with lower end customers. It's in their what they call the power base range of products. But it's very interesting to see the innovation that's happening at sort of this base level. Like, you can spend little money and get products that are getting more and more professional. Core has spearheaded this sort of a USB-C power charging capability too. So you plug in a USB, you can then stack a whole bunch of batteries on top and it charges them all at once, which is pretty clever. And they kind of made a PTAP-esque plastic housing around USB-C, so you can put it in different directions and has a little bit more of a bigger bite. So yeah, it's interesting. There definitely is innovation. Arri has a broadcast live multicam sort of version of the Alexa 65 that debuted. There are things that are happening. They had new LCD lights, but to our core demographic of, you know, I would say people who work in the industry as filmmakers, as cinematographers, as producers, directors, these things are news, but probably not too impactful on the day-to-day. What's really interesting about NAB is how so much of the conference has sort of like shifted to streaming and large companies like Google Cloud and Amazon Web Services, all these other services. I met these people, very interesting people, who do data transmission only across the internet for large streamers and large providers like across the UK and around the world. So like, let's say you've got a production happening in a stadium in the UK. To get that signal up to the cloud and then distribute that to where you need it to go, that's all they do. They just handle that section of it. And NAB still has like radio broadcasters and some of the other types of electronic sales.
Whenever I go
sales
to NAB, I wander over to that stuff and kind of like scratch my head and say, I don't understand anything about radio antennas.
Exactly. There's still some of that, but it's very interesting how much of it seems to be now cloud-based, how much of it seems to be based on sort of like the IT area. There is definitely sort of a merging of broadcast and cinema and streaming all kind of coming together. It's not a standout year where I could say like, oh, like last year, virtual production is the theme. Virtual production is everywhere. It's not like the years that 3D was sort of like the fad or the flavor du jour.
3D or DSLRs. I remember when DSLRs took over the whole place.
So it's interesting to me, though, that it also seemed to be the poorest attended NAB in years. Now,
really?
They said that 65,000 people were there. It did not seem like 65,000 people to me. It seemed significantly less. And the way that I kind of judge that is how much waiting and how many crowds I have to kind of like get through to get to places and do things. And it just didn't feel like there was a lot of crowds. Now, granted, there is construction going on and a lot of stuff is moved over to the west side, the west new west hall. But so I think that spreads it out a bit. And so it probably feels less crowded because of that. But I think it was a lower year. They might have had 65,000 registries, but I'm going to say it felt like 2021 to me. It felt like, you know, much lighter. So I don't know. Anyway, NAB is over. There is not a big...
And before we move on, though, did our friend Michael Cioni and Strata win some award or something there?
They did. They won an award. They won a Best of Show award. I think they actually won like two or three awards, so which is really interesting. Now, I talked a little bit about the Sony Burano won a Camera of the Year award, but here's the thing. Awards at shows like this are always interesting because sometimes they're given to concepts, sometimes they're given to full-fledged products, but Estrada is still in this very much beta sort of startup mode. So I'm glad that they were recognized and so many people, I think, like Michael and really appreciate what he's doing. And he did throw a killer party. I got to meet like, you know, some of his team. We got to go hang out for a bit, but it's, I can't wait to actually get my hands on it. I haven't not part of his like,
if I had a production, I would be really bothering him to let me get in on the private beta. And I do have a production that might be going late summer, early fall. I assume that they'll at least be in public beta or possibly fully released by then. And if that's the case, you know, hopefully we can get on it, because I even literally just saw an editor complain about how he didn't have AI that could just meta tag everything that he did. And I was like, YouTube video.
Just wait. It's
coming. It exists. Yeah. I mean, like he was saying, like, I watch all the footage down, but there's always that moment where, and I, as an editor, I've been in this myself, where it's like, I know that there's one shot where a dog runs by in the background. I want that shot. And you just, you know, you end up spending an hour and a half micro searching through every take to see which one it was. And once that's out, I mean, to me, the fact that that's all automated is just such a game changer.
I agree. And we'll all get to experience, the magic of Michael's new system here, hopefully sooner rather than later. And I really think that he's got the right idea and that really AI tools to relieve drudgery is how most people will be using AI. They're not going to be creating a new whiz bang movie by putting a few prompts in and getting a couple of short videos.
Somebody will. It's just not going to. It's never going to, in my opinion, it's never going to be any good. It's going to be, it'll be novel.
Yes.
It'll be novel as fuck when somebody does that, but it's not going to be actively good.
It's actually going to be actively bad. It's going to be the opposite of good. It will actually really, really be terrible. And people will be like, God, why am I watching this? You know, people made fun of the Polar Express. Just wait to the stuff that's going to come from AI. So Ben, I think we should get to the interview with Kyle Roberts.
Here's Kyle.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Kyle Roberts, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, man.
Hey, you're a DP and you're working out of New Orleans, is that correct?
I am actually in Birmingham, Alabama right now. We bought a house in Birmingham.
Did you used to be in New Orleans?
I used to be in Atlanta, so it's all very confusing, but yeah, Southeast for sure.
Oh no, you were working in New Orleans, I think is what it was when I spoke with you. For some reason, I have New Orleans in my head. You know, just before recording, you and I were talking about this. We've known each other a very long time. It's probably going on like 8, almost 10 years now. It's been a bit, but we haven't seen each other in person since long before the pandemic, since you used to work at a camera rental house called West Coast Cameras. Was that right?
I did, yeah. So I was at West Coast Camera when we met, which I think was 2015 or 2016. Two really big first ACs in LA, like owned a rental house, and they would go off to Atlanta and New York and do their thing. And me and my buddy Zach would kind of run the show there. So I was a prep tech, QC tech, all in one there because it was very boutique. Yeah, but that's when we met.
So, all right, catch me up. You've had a lot of things happen in your life since you were a prep tech working at West Coast. Tell us a little bit about the type of work that you do now and working out of Birmingham, Alabama.
Sure. So I'll do a little bit of background. I was literally driving across the country, headed to Atlanta, thinking I was getting on Guardians 2, you know, as a utility, like everything was happening. And I get a call from an old buddy in Birmingham. I did some Compass Bank commercials and stuff years ago, saying, hey, man, our producer, which is what they would call like a DP at an agency here, is going on a military leave. Like he's going to fight the good fight, right? So can you come fill in for a month? And I was like, oh, wow. We'll be able to stop in and see my parents and, you know, catch up and I'll do that. I'll cover for them at this little agency and then we'll jet off to Atlanta. I have some time because there was prep anyway. Well, that turned into extending me into a 3-month contract and then a year contract. And then we bought a house and stayed here because I was like at an agency and shooting and doing all the corporate-y commercial stuff here. The first 3 years I was back actually. Yeah. So,
man, I got to say, you keep busy. Like, I follow your Instagram. I follow, you know, what you put out into the world in social media. And every once in a while, we have a good email exchange where we catch up a little bit. But I would say that of people who are listening to the show, who particularly work in like regional commercials and different forms of branded content creation, you're a busy guy. You're doing stuff all the time. And you kind of pepper in narrative work and music videos and other things. How do you split your time, or how do you like to split your time? Obviously, you got to pay the bills, but what kind of work is most fulfilling for you?
Yeah, I would say that's two different answers. What I love to do is narrative, you know, and I'm like a gritty, dark, underexposed kind of DP, but commercials pay the bills for me a lot, you know, so I'll even gaff or cam op, you know, if some big feature comes through. But when I DP, I like to do the weird, the Fincher-y kind of dark and gritty stuff. And that's kind of what I'm known for. But yeah, I'll do a fashion film here, a music video there for fun, you know. Those don't always pay the bills, but the commercial work and stuff for universities and branded content, yeah, is where I spend a lot of my time for sure.
All right. So Alabama, definitely a smaller market than centers like, you know, LA and Atlanta. You've worked in all these places. Can you describe the work-life reality in these different places? You know, not too many people get that experience of getting to work in small market, large market, maybe even mid markets, because like I was saying before, I seem to remember in my brain something about you also working in New Orleans for a period of time. Maybe it was a job, but tell me about these different centers and what production life is like.
Yeah, so I would say Birmingham and Montgomery and Tuscaloosa, kind of this central Alabama hub, if you will, didn't exist for real when I left for LA in 2013, you know. It was very small commercials, very indie stuff, you know. We're out there with Lowell Totas and 5Ds at the most. And then I went out to LA and did the rental house thing. And as I've come back, I've tried to bring that kind of bigger production here, you know what I mean? We are 2 hours from Atlanta, so I do a ton of work in Atlanta. You know, they boomed while I was gone, which was kind of drawing me back. Nashville's 3 hours from my front door, and New Orleans is probably 4.5. So I'm kind of in this central zone where I work local in those places a lot. You know, we have a couple of grip vans and G&E, and I'll go with a one ton and me show up and kind of either be the gaffer or the DP on these smaller projects. Or, you know, I have a rental house in Birmingham, so that's where I fill in the gaps for sure. But we have shows come through probably one feature at a time. You know, it's never swamped here. But if we're not on that, and my partner, Kevin Key, is the big DIT in town. So if one of us is not on that show and we can get equipment on that, you know, usually the other one's driving the box truck down to Mobile or to New Orleans and trying to get some equipment working, you know, at the same time as we're using that to step onto a lot of these jobs, which is awesome.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship with the gear and production. You've got a rental house, and I have to imagine that for producers or people who want you for different sorts of branded content or for narrative productions, that's a big draw. I assume you don't have a ton of competition in your market, or do you? I really don't know.
Yeah. So a long time ago, there was one 3-ton box truck like in the state, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, 10 years ago. Now it's like we have three of those, and there's one more kind of grip house in town, Champion Lighting. So there's not a ton of competition on that side. And we're the kind of rental house that does everything, you know, I mean, we have Alexas and Venices as well. So I'm more of the camera and lens techie kind of guy also. So that's where we do a lot of our business. But yeah, it's great for a producer to call and say, hey, you know, we need an LED wall and we need some aperture lights. And, you know, we can kind of check all those boxes. They can do one invoice and everything can run through us, which is great. Yeah.
That's super cool. I have heard about the production community, particularly around Birmingham, getting much larger recently. And I don't know if it's because of tax incentives. Are tax incentives playing a role at all in the jobs, or is it mostly local work that's around you?
There are certainly tax incentives here, but you have to get to that $500K or $1 million budget, you know, tier one to even kick in that stuff. So I'm not really at that level. Like, I don't work on a ton of those jobs. I'll go on and be the BTS guy, or I'll be the best boy. You know, I still get work those ways. But for me, I'm doing a lot of indie features, you know, regional commercials, that budget level stuff. And really, there's not enough crew here to sustain more than one, you know, bigger budget film at a time.
Yeah, I came up in San Francisco. I'm now in Portland, Oregon, and only in Los Angeles, you know, part-time. And my big takeaway is that it feels like Portland's very much like San Francisco in the 90s. There's really, you know, a certain number of crews that can handle the amount of commercial or feature work, but it's not a big market. It's not like Los Angeles where you throw a rock and you hit six gaffers. It's not like, you know, yeah. It's not the same sort of thing. So it sounds to me that like where you're at, a certain amount of work flexibility and not necessarily being jack of all trades, but probably having a few different trades. Yeah, that keeps the money coming in. It keeps stuff going. And you've got multiple revenue streams from, you know, rental house, yourself as labor, your own commercial production. How does that sort of, you know, if you don't mind sharing, if you could break it down for our audience, how does your work-life balance break down with that sort of thing? What's the income wedge? Is rentals like 80% of your income? Is it 10% of your income? You don't have to talk pure numbers, yeah. But just sort of like percentage-wise.
For sure. I would say doing multiple jobs is definitely how I'm able to stay busy enough. Like I was so busy that I left an agency, you know, that had 60K a year check mark and I could do freelance. Also, to get that busy, though, it's like you said, I'm having to gaff and cam op and DP and edit the last short film that I shot. I was also asked to edit it because I'm really close with the director. And that was awesome. So, you know, it's just filling in those gaps. But I would say rentals isn't the biggest thing here. We have, Kevin and I have purchased equipment that we want to use and we enjoy using, and it makes us money like when we're not working, if that makes sense. I would probably say that's 15 or 20% of my income. Yeah, not crazy, but...
Yeah, but you know, not a kick in the pants either. It's good to have to have those, especially when times are slow. And I was just talking to you about this, like, you know, we just went through the strikes in Los Angeles and New York and Atlanta. I know really, really felt it, but it seems like you stayed pretty busy. Seems like you had a pretty decent last 6 months or so. When the rest of the world was slowing down, do you feel like that diversity keeps you floating, keeps you going by, keeps you able to do those different things?
I think so, yeah. And a lot of it's the corporate clients, you know, the Alabama Powers and the AT&Ts of the world, that they got to spend their marketing money no matter what, you know what I mean? Commercial world, that kind of stuff. Obviously, features slowed down here significantly and a lot of other people were hurting. But since I do several different jobs, even ESPN came calling. We did some Monday Night Football stuff and some game day stuff as it got into football. Being really the only game in town that can handle that stuff certainly helped us for sure. And then we did some travel jobs, like, you know, we did a big 5-camera shoot for a boxing match, in Arizona. That was really cool. And that's a month worth of income that you prep for 5 days, you go shoot for 3 days. You know, it was big for us, you know, because we got all of our equipment on it and me and Kevin went, and that was great. Yeah, but to stay busy, I think I have to kind of spread everything out. And also I train up people. So it's like I get these calls and I'm double booked or whatever. Then I have my gaffer go handle blank, or, you know, just having buddies in this market. We know everybody in Birmingham. You know, I'm from here originally. And so definitely connections is what keeps me busy. Definitely.
Yeah. Are there studio spaces there? Is studio work a reality in Birmingham, or do you have to travel for stages?
So there's only one real soundstage, and it's like a music venue / soundstage in Birmingham. It's not ideal, but you can drive a car onto it. Mm. And then other than that, it's kind of like our 6,000 square foot studio that we also have. With a, you know, the LED volume, doing the Mandalorian type tech. That's the other big thing in town. Yeah.
Well, you haven't named your rental house or your studio. Why don't you shout this out? You know, no one's going to blame you for self-promotion. I mean, this is the time to do it.
Yeah. So Field of View is my rental company, and Next Level Productions is me as a freelancer. And that's how I get a lot of jobs. But then Moon Men is kind of the place where we have the LED wall and the space. You know, you can come with the hair and makeup and all the gack that comes along with the studio.
Nice. And we'll put links to those in the show notes on our official website, Cam Noir, and also on YouTube below this video. Kyle, you mentioned you train up other crew members, people who are interested in getting into it. Can you talk a little bit about sort of that, the environment for crew? Because my experience being in a smaller market, you really kind of had two types of people. And maybe it was just San Francisco in particular, but I've talked to some people in Albuquerque and some other places, and they've kind of reaffirmed for me that you either have people who are highly collaborative, who really want to be able to refer work to each other and try to help train each other and try to, like, you know, the proverbial borrowing a cup cup of filmmaking sugar to try to keep things going. And then he had people who were like extremely competitive. Like, you know, they had to fight tooth and nail for everything they ever got. And they consider everyone else like their competition. They don't want to be helpful at all. Have you had that experience? Is that the personality types you run into, or am I totally off base here?
So a big reason that I left LA, and we loved the weather, and my wife went to grad school there, you know, we named our child Melrose. Like, we loved a lot of things about LA, but one of the things we didn't love was just the such the competitive nature and like the step on you. So if I get up a level, you know, that kind of vibe and just the busyness factor. And so it's been very nice to be back in a market where there's hungry, young kids coming up out of film school. Like, I taught at a school and volunteer at Sidewalk. That's the film festival here, and do a lot of those things to train up that next generation. And I have a passion for that. Whereas, like you say, not everybody's like that, but you know, you hope that you kind of scratch somebody's back and they'll hit you back with a job, and that kind of happens a lot. So I enjoy that for sure.
Yeah, I think that I'm always really impressed when I go to smaller markets and I find that camaraderie. I find the people who really are trying to collaborate in all kinds of meaningful ways, work on each other's stuff as favors, work, you know, anything they can to try to like elevate the community, elevate the perception of the area for production to come in and work there. It's same for you. I assume that with, you know, those people with having a rental house, with having gear, you probably get hit up all the time for those sorts of favors. Is that a reality of the market, or do you try to be a good neighbor? How does that work?
Yeah, I think I get hit up a lot having a studio in a rental house for recommendations, you know, and I'm not always trying to send myself. A lot of times it's, hey, do you have a sound guy? Do you know who's a good grip in town? You know, sending out other roles and then hoping that they might do the same, which is cool. But we love Birmingham, being born and raised here. And the problem is, you know, Atlanta blew up so fast that some bad things were happening because they didn't have enough crew. We certainly don't want that to happen here. We always try to train up the person under us and you know, two down from us and bring that along so that when we're booked, you know, I can recommend people and know that they're going to go knock it out of the park for sure. Yeah. And we still trade favors. You know, one of my favorite directors, Evan, we went to school at UAB together a million years ago. You know, I met her in 2006. So we still work on each other's projects and I try to help her out, do it everything I can. And that happens for sure.
Nice. All right, so let's talk about you then. So I've seen some of your work. I just saw a short film that you did that was awesome. You own a lot of gear. When you're showing up on jobs, I assume, you're bringing all your own, you know, toys to play with this. And how important would the technology package be in you doing some of this work? Is your gear on every job that you do? Do you sometimes just get hired out and you're working with a package? What is the relationship between you and the tools that you're using?
I would say 95% of my jobs, I'm bringing an Alexa or a Venice, you know, some Leicas, like some gear that I own. Yes, I'd like to, you know, sub rent some Orions because we really wanted to go anamorphic and that kind of thing. That happens for sure. But I'm not at a level to where we can get mini LFs and we're shooting six cameras and that kind of stuff. A lot of times we're bringing our own gear, and me being so techie, you know, and knowing a lot of people helps fill in the crew at a certain budget level that we can over deliver. You know, that's always what I'm trying to preach is let's elevate this project because we can bring this, this, and this, and I can bring extra people, or we can stay late. Like, obviously Birmingham is non-union. Like, we can do all those things to try to elevate the project for sure.
So look, I didn't intend necessarily that when we started this conversation, it was going to be so much gear focused, because we actually don't talk a lot about gear on the podcast. But as you are a gearhead and you've got a company that does a lot with gear and you yourself use a lot of gear, I kind of want to keep treading over this territory because I don't get to do this very often. One of the things I'm experiencing is a lot of people asking us about FX3s, asking us about FX3s plus gimbals, asking us about, you know, the creator has... Let me tell you, Sony ought to be giving them a big kickback right now because there's been so many people talking about that camera since the movie came out. What's going on where you're at? Are you having the same experience?
Dude, all people are talking about and asking me about is Sony. You know what I mean? It was a big Canon and Red town forever, you know, and we kind of got the first Alexa, but now it's like how many FX3s are you guys going to buy? And it's like, well, we didn't buy them when they came out. We're not going to just buy a million of those because the creator came out. Yeah, it looks great, but it's tiny. I get that. The HDMI and the having to rig it all up is, you know, we got a couple FX6s and it's the same sensor, you know, those are great, but trying to problem solve around that is not really my game. But that's certainly what everyone's talking about right now. It's like, you can get that for $3,500 or whatever. I'm like, yeah, dude, go get you one.
You know, the big split between professional gear, and I know that you know this, especially like, you know, FX3, FX6, FX9, really what you're talking about is differences between these cameras are sort of creature comforts and how easy it is to work with them and how you can switch between one mode or have a feature this, that, or the other. Sony actually uses that same sensor, that same really good sensor that's in the FX3 in lower end cameras. And I would consider the A7S III a lower end camera just slightly, even though it's, you know, essentially image wise, it's the same. But I don't know if you know this. They use that same sensor in an even less expensive lower end camera. Mm-hmm. It's a camera that they sell to vloggers. They call the ZV-1. It's startlingly good. I mean, it'll do 120 frames per second at 4K. And it's a $2,200 camera. So look, in the world out there of like of FX3 being elevated now to a camera on a movie that is, you know, being shown in IMAX. I used to have this saying that when DV, back in the era of DV, there is no DV anymore. When DV
log and transfer, baby, let's go.
So when DV looks like IMAX, no one's going to mourn the loss of film. And I kind of feel like we're there. I feel like some of the stuff looks so good now. It's never looked as good as it does. And it's interesting because there was a really great camera test that HBO put together called the Camera Assessment Series. By any chance, have you seen this?
They showed no, I've never heard of it.
You can't just screen it on the internet. It's not, doesn't exist out there. But the Camera Assessment Series is brilliant. And they do a test between the Alexa 35, the Sony Venice 2, the Red V Raptor, the Blackmagic 12K, the original Alexa Mini, and 35 millimeter film. And it is scientifically put together by Sonny Bear, who's a friend of mine I've known for a long time. And it is done impeccably well to make sure that it is really an apples to apples test. And there's reasons why they don't put it on the internet. It is only for screening in proper environments. And the way that you in the past got to see an HBO camera assessment series test is you made a multi-million dollar show for HBO. And then you got to go into the screening rooms or the edit bays, and they'd pull up any of the years of the camera assessment series. So you could go through and you could watch and compare and you could do a lot of stuff. This year, they did not use 35 millimeter film as the reference, the be all end all, but it was included. And I thought it really was important that it was included because there is almost this, not going to say nostalgia, but like mystical quality about film that people say like, oh, you couldn't achieve this any other way, or film is so amazing. But the reality is that when you see film now next to all of these other camera formats, and granted it wasn't IMAX, but still, if you extrapolate, the same issues that exist with 35 millimeter film exist with IMAX, and particularly sensitivity and noise. And 35 millimeter film now trying to compete at, you know, they did special push processing to try to boost the equivalent ISO up. And holy crap, it stood out like a sore thumb every time they did anything that involved low light, anything, you know, about the sort of like deep dynamic range, being able to see things down the shadows. Film did not look particularly great. As a matter of fact, I would say film lost almost every test in the HBO series. So I don't know. You tell me, are people coming into town shooting film or asking you for film? Is film even on the radar anymore? What is, I mean, I know you did film back in the day. So how does film equate now for you?
Nobody talks about film here. And it might just be that, you know, it's like old timers like me and then another generation. But this past summer, I know somebody shot some 16 mil film for a very gritty like boxing movie, but that's like for, they wanted it to be degraded, you know, like for the bad things about it, how grainy it was, and you know, the not so milky blacks, they're completely crushed on 16, you know. I think they were going for a lot of those things. But yeah, the dynamic range at this point, like you're saying, Venice 2, Alexa 35 is like absurd, you know what I mean? I don't even do, this is very techie, but I don't even shoot in the 3200 mode because it's dark outside. Sometimes I'll go to that mode just because it's so clean for the bright and happy stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just those, the creamy skin tones, and there's no more noise. So it's like, why not? You know what I mean? We can light it less. So it, yeah, it's a crazy time for sure.
Well, let's jump way back. You went to school, you got out into Los Angeles, you've done all this different sort of work. It's not easy to learn all of these different crafts. I mean, all, you know, to be able to bifurcate your brain and be able to be entrepreneur and to be camera operator and to be gaffer and all these different things. Tell us a little bit about your story. How did this start for you? How did you make this happen?
Okay, so I'm a drummer and I was in a touring band 2005 to 2009. And we kind of fell in love with LA touring the country. And so my wife and I visited in 2010 and came out there just as soon as we got married in 2012. And for me, I've always had that creative brain, that outlet that wants to create like constantly. You know, if I have a week where I'm dead, it's not that there's the bills aren't getting paid. It's that I'm not getting to work on something and put my brain to work, you know? And so when I got out there being so techie, you know, I got in at Radiant Images super fast, moved right up into QC and, you know, was servicing cameras and that kind of stuff. And that's not because I knew how to do that when I walked in the door. It's just that I'm so go-getter and so techie that, you know, it just happened that way. And so that's how I met a lot of people. You know, I came out there as a DP, but shooting smaller commercials here, a couple features before I came out. And meeting so many people at rental houses, being the techie one that's cleaning the sensors and, you know, showing them how to use, you know, the new Arri follow focus as it comes out, you know, like people would bring me on jobs as their AC a lot or as their gaffer, because just because I feel like they wanted me to be there to be a good hang, but also like to be the one that can troubleshoot. I'm a big problem solver, I guess. And so I feel like my career has taken off mainly because I'm the guy that can not just do multiple jobs, but, you know, the Teradek goes down, you know, you're on an indie feature, there's not a replacement. We got to get that thing back up. You know what I mean? So I feel like that's a lot of what I bring to the table. And my eye, you know, as the years have progressed, has honed and gotten better. But it's that creative mind, the problem solving. That's what's taken me far. And that's what still brings me every day to the table, because I could go be a banker and make a ton of money, but that'd be boring, you know?
Yeah, there is something about this industry where you don't necessarily know when your day is going to start, when it's going to end, or where you're going to be. But that variety, that sort of variety of having to do something different, you know, almost every single day or every single job, there's not the same repetition. There's not the same of like, hey, you're going to go stand at a desk, you're going to go do X, Y, and Z, and then you're going to go home. Is that variety sort of like what keeps you going then too? Or, I mean, or do you find that the industry just gets monotonous? What's your feeling on this?
It's definitely the variety. If I was just doing corporate, you know, and just lighting bright white spaces every day, I think I'd get bored. But it's also the challenge of, you know, continually making my work better when maybe you show up and it's boring, or you don't have all the tools that day, or, you know, your key grip is sick or whatever, you know, and having to step in and problem solve that location, those hours. You know, sometimes you see a schedule and it's 8 pages and you're just like, oh my gosh, how are we going to get this? You know, and then everybody coming together and the actors nail it. And, you know, you have a good director you're working with. When you finish that, there's almost that come down like you're coming back from vacation, because it's just like so much awesome in 12 hours, you know. But then it's like, what's the next thing? You know, what can I put my mind to next, for sure? And that variety, 100%.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, this has been so much fun. I've really enjoyed our conversation. If someone wants to reach out to you or connect with you, where would you like to most have them go? Do you have an Instagram or a website? Is there someplace you want to shout out?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram all the time. So at Next Level Film, you know, I'll respond immediately. That's where I post stills, but a lot more in the past couple of years, frames from finished projects, you know, trying to keep stuff hidden until it's out there. But yeah, the film festival circuit, we hope, is going to be great this year. I've shot a few things that's out there. And just hit me up on Instagram. It'll be awesome.
Nice. Hey, Kyle, thanks so much for coming on the show and chatting with me. It was great to catch up. It's been way too long. And I can't wait to see your next project. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks so much, man.
All right, that was Kyle Roberts. Kyle, thanks again for being on the show. It was great to, you know, catch up and to hear all about all the work you're doing in Alabama. Definitely looking forward to getting an update whenever you've got something cool going on. Thanks.
Thank you. It's awesome.
And now, Short Ends.
So, Ben, it is our famed short end time of the show. It's the time when we talk about our obsessions. It's the time that we talk about, you know, stuff that we're really into, stuff that we think is novel and important and is worthy of spending a few minutes to chat about. What is your obsession this week?
It's less of an obsession and more of just kind of a bummer.
Oh.
And that's Participant Media, which has been a pretty active player in the movie world. And I think they're probably best known for making the Al Gore documentary An Inconvenient Truth. But they also made Food Incorporated. They made a lot of like really good documentaries. They also made narrative films, and they've been around for about 20 years, and they hung up their spurs this week. Mm. And I think that they're just having a hard time, as everyone is, kind of competing in the movie space. Like, you know, it's taking a while for movies to come back post-pandemic. People figured out other things to do with their lives other than going to a movie theater. I tend to think also that, like, we were told so long, like, don't be in a small contained space with other people. Why would you go do a thing that is only that? I personally have gone to tons of movies, haven't got COVID at any of them. Anyway, it's just kind of a bummer. I think that they were a good faith actor in the movie creation space. And I know that there's more behind the story of why they stopped, and maybe someone will come and fill that up. But to me, whenever like an independent, you know, non-studio company folds, especially someone who made indie films that were kind of purpose-driven, bums me out. I'm just, you know, bummed out. So, you know, pour one out for Participant Media.
Yeah, that's too bad. Participant, you know, definitely famous in the indie world for quite a while. I remember seeing their logo before many movies. So,
and I mean, you know, the thing is, companies come and companies go. Like, I remember when the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke, and, you know, the Weinstein company went down, there was kind of this feeling of like, well, who will take up that space? Like, what will happen to the indie films that would have been championed? And I'm not saying that any amount of championing indie films is worth the cost of having Harvey Weinstein being a predator out in the world. Not at all. But you do wonder, like, where does the next Quentin Tarantino or whatever come from? And that was right around the time of the rise of A24, you know, and A24 was already around, but they started doing more stuff, and companies like A24 and Neon kind of come in and fill in that area. So I'm not necessarily worried, but I like to have it, it's a voice that I thought was a voice for good in cinema. So that's my short end.
Yeah. Rest in peace, Participant.
Yeah. Participate in heaven. All right. Ilya, what is your short end?
It's a television series you can watch right now on Amazon Prime called Fallout. Have you seen Fallout?
You're like the 200th person to tell me I need to see it. I haven't seen any of it yet. I was so busy the last 3 weeks that I haven't really had time to sit down and watch television without falling asleep.
It is a certain sort of dark sensibility I think that you would really be into in particular, so you should definitely check it out. The show is created by Jonathan Nolan, who's been working in television for a long time, executive produced by Lisa Joy, who's definitely also been around, and it is based on the Bethesda game called Fallout, which is now a series. They're up to number 4. But beyond all that, I think it's quite interesting that unlike The Last of Us, they didn't feel the need to make it like straight out of the game, like you're recreating the game as a live-action television series. It is set in the world and inspired by what happens in the game, but it is its own thing. And it does it really, really well. As a matter of fact, the creators of the show have given a lot of credit to The Last of Us, saying that the success of that show probably kicked open and made it, you know, made it more possible for a show like Fallout to get made. Mm. And they've already greenlit season 2. The early buzz has been huge. I got to say, it's really sort of like captured the imagination. There's a little bit of like, I don't want to quite say steampunk, but it's like science fiction out of, 1950s sci-fi. So there's sort of like a 1950s sci-fi element. And there's a really great soundtrack where they bring in all this sort of like, you know, period music. And at the same time, it's sort of gory violence and all sorts of like mutant creatures. So those are
You had me at gory violence and mutant creatures.
I know I did. I know this is totally up your alley. So Matt Berry does the voice and has a cameo. I have not finished the season yet, but so far we've seen Matt Berry on screen once, but heard his voice a couple of times. He plays, his voice is given to a robot called Mr. Handy that will harvest people's organs. So, you know, he's a fantastic from, of course, you know, shows like, What We Do in the Shadows, and just a tremendous comedy actor. So there's all kinds of like little surprises in there. And really, really worth checking out. You should, if you haven't seen Fallout or tried Fallout and you're listening to the sound of my voice and you're not turned off by gory violence and crazy, you know, mutant creatures, then this is your jam. You're gonna enjoy it.
Sweet. I will definitely check it out. I mean, like, seriously, last week I've been like 50 people have told me I needed to watch that show. So,
as you should. So, Ben, I think that just about does it for us this week. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
Definitely find me at benrock.com. That's the easiest, most direct place to find me, all my socials, watch my reel, figure out what I'm all about, read my bio. It was really fun writing my bio. I hate writing my bio. Yeah. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Red Cameras, hotredcameras.com, soon to have Hot Red Cameras Portland. That's actually, I know, we're working on it right now. Maybe another 6 weeks. I'll keep you posted when that happens.
Is it just like the regular hot rod cameras I'm used to, but you put birds on everything?
Yes.
Put a bird on it.
Yes. It is Hot Rod Cameras, but smaller. We took the sort of R&D facility out of Hot Rod Cameras LA, brought that up to Portland. And if we, and I was kind of hoping that we'd find a building where we might be able to do both the R&D and create a new retail space. We're still going to sell Airy and Red and Cook and all the sort of like, you know, big brands that we sell, but it's going to be, you know, probably attenuated a little bit more towards the Portland audience. So I don't know exactly what that will be. Maybe it'll be more audio. We do, you know, Rode and Deity and all sorts of like, you know, audio stuff too. Maybe that will be the thing. Or we do a bunch of lights. So it'll probably be maybe smaller lights. I'm really not sure what Portland wants, but we have a little bit of everything. So
Introduced you to my friend Greg Hale, the producer from Blair Witch Project. He lives in Portland and has made occasional films there.
That would be fun. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so Ben, who do we have to thank this week?
Who don't we have to thank for this week?
That's true.
First, we should definitely thank Alana Cody, who is really kicking a bunch of ass and getting a bunch of really cool interviews. We've both done a couple interviews in the last few days, and they're going to be coming up hopefully in the next few weeks. And I've got one that I got to do on Wednesday that I'm extraordinarily excited about. So I never name them ahead of time because if you know stuff gets rescheduled, but goddamn, I'm excited. We got to thank our good friend Ben Katz, who we made his job not as easy as we could have today, but Ben is an amazing editor. He puts the show together. He's a really swell guy and damn funny, if I may say so. If you follow him on social media, he's a very funny guy. And last but never least, thank Kays Alatrachi, who created every scrap of music you've heard on this podcast. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Hire him to compose a score for your next film or video or whatever, or you could hire him to direct it, or you could hire him to color grade it, or you could hire him to do VFX. He's so good at all of those things, and I'm not joking. I'm not even joking a little.
He doesn't have room on his business card for all those things. So
he has like a business tablet. It's like it's like the Ten Commandments from History of the World Part 1.
These 15, oops, 10 commandments. Yes, I recall well. All right, so Ben, I'll take us out this week if you're ready.
All right.
Until next time.
All right. That's so,
it's so
cheesy.
Goofy. Until next time. I think there's a way to do it. I just don't know what that is.
Keep on shooting. I don't know. We need something better. Anyway.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.